you know, have used images that I have seen in front of my eyes, where a vaccinator would carry a big vaccine box on the top of his head, standing in knee-deep water in flooded villages of northern Bihar in India. That's the weightlifting champion of the Global Health Olympics for me.
Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. I'm director of the Oxford Vaccine Group at the University of Oxford. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, facts, and people behind the science. On this episode, I'm going to be speaking with one of the leading experts on polio research and the eradication of this virus from the planet, which will be the second ever eradicated if and when it happens. Ananda Bandyopadhyay, Deputy Director at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the polio team. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Andy. Such a pleasure to be here.
Ananda, terrific to have you here, not only as the Deputy Director at the polio team at the Gates Foundation, but also my polio guru, which I think makes it special to have you come and talk to us on this podcast. Now, you coordinate the global research agenda from the Gates Foundation on polio, and it's the attempts to actually eradicate this virus from the planet. So how did you end up going into medicine and then into this really critical area of health policy?
Sure, Andy. Again, such an honor to be with you here. So yes, I grew up in India, in Kolkata, to be precise, a city in the eastern part of India. I decided to go and study medicine. That was more or less the passion from my high school onwards. And then while doing my medical studies, by the end of it, as we were getting exposed to the clinical practice, I could see the burden of vaccine-preventable diseases that was there in the country at that point of time. So that drew me into studying more and understanding more the dynamics of vaccine-preventable diseases. So following my medical internship, I decided to take a break. I thought I would go and do some field work before getting back to clinical practice. So my exposure to start with of that field work was as a surveillance medical officer for World Health Organization, the National Polio Surveillance Project, that they would call it at that time. And I was placed in a remote corner of India, essentially doing polio surveillance and mass vaccination campaign monitoring, lot of outbreak response planning. So that was my exposure to shoe leather epidemiology. And Andy, I never came back to clinical practice. I was fascinated by this direct exposure to the communities, the part of India that I didn't know existed, growing up in a city. And then you suddenly get exposed to the rural areas, the problems there, the people, the difficulty in access and so forth. So again, bottom line, I was fascinated. I stayed back for about 4 years. And this was the period that India was intensely endemic for polio. It was the time that India contributed about 2/3 of all paralytic polio cases in the world. So that's how it started. And then I decided to get formally trained in infectious diseases and public health. And then eventually, about 12 years ago, I joined the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Polio was gone from India by then, but not from the world. So that was the driver. But at the Gates Foundation, my role has been to focus on, as you noted, to coordinate polio research. So everything related to polio vaccine research, be it new vaccine development, generating data on existing vaccines, making the vaccines more affordable, more accessible, and then also surveillance-related innovation. That's all that I have been focusing on over the past 12 years, but that's how I ended up here.
So growing up here in the UK, I saw many people who'd been affected by polio, because here in Europe, we had huge polio epidemics in the 1950s, which really drove the development of polio vaccines, which were then rolled out from the late 1950s. And the people that I remember growing up were people who had paralysis, usually in their legs, from having had very severe polio as children in the 1950s. But I've been a paediatrician for 30 years, and I've never seen a case of polio. But it sounds like you were seeing cases when you were a junior doctor and a medical officer in India.
That's absolutely right, Andy. So, let me take you back to, you know, my days before getting into medical school. So I think one thing that connects you and I, UK and India, is cricket, right? And, you know, I remember growing up.
I think we always win, though, don't we?
Oh, excuse me. I think we should change the topic now. But in all seriousness, I remember in my own neighborhood, there would be occasional times when, you know, one of our cricket buddies wouldn't turn up. And then eventually we'll get to know that the person, the child, was affected with acute onset paralysis. I didn't know what was going on then, but I could tell in retrospect that some of those children were affected with polio. It was very real, Andy, growing up in the 1980s in India as a school-going child. And then, yes, studying in the medical school in Kolkata, we would also occasionally see not only new cases, sudden onset paralysis, but also people who have had polio in the past and still were affected with that. So again, yes, these were very real.
And so the polio is caused by a virus. How is that virus transmitted between people? And what sort of spectrum of disease does it cause? Does everyone get paralyzed?
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Polio, you know, is quite a spectrum, you know, both the virus and then the disease or the presentation. So let me break it down a little bit. It can be caused by three different serotypes of the virus. The virus is the polio virus that we are talking about. So there are these type 1, type 2, and type 3 polio. And then from another perspective, we can also divide the polio disease as caused by the naturally occurring virus. We call it the wild polio virus. There could also be a vaccine-derived variant of polio, and we'll come to that in a little bit maybe, but that can also be of these three types. It's quite a complex spectrum. In terms of how it spreads, it does spread through the fecal-oral route predominantly. So in the highest risk settings, it's that spread through the excretion of the virus, and then through not so good sanitary and hygiene practices in some parts of the world. It can also spread through oral route, but that route is probably restricted to the more developed settings. And then it also depends, Andy, on the time of from when the person was infected. So initially, for the first 7 to 10 days, the virus is shed both through nasopharyngeal, oropharyngeal secretions, and intestinal secretion. But then over time, you know, post 2 to 4 weeks of the first exposure to the virus, it's typically predominantly intestinal excretion. And then about 4 to 6 weeks from the time of first exposure, typically in immunocompetent individuals, the excretion would stop. So that's how the virus is shed.
So it's actually shed for a very long period of time, which gives lots of opportunity for it to transmit to another person.
Spot on. So that underscores the risk of this virus and the disease. So coming back to your original question, polio virus infection mostly presents as no symptoms. Only in about 1% of all who would be infected one would see the classic signs and symptoms of paralysis, typically asymmetric sudden onset paralysis, typically of the lower limb, can affect actually any part of the body. But that's the broad spectrum. But I would underscore again, it's a highly infectious virus. So even if it's not causing paralysis in most of the individuals infected, it can spread very rapidly. And that brings me to the third aspect of this virus or disease, and that is the outbreak proneness. Its propensity to spread not only from one person to another, one household to the other, one community to the other, but from one country, one global region to the other. And that's what makes it so difficult from a public health perspective to control, to stop and interrupt. And that's one of the reasons that it is still designated as a public health emergency of international concern.
Clearly today we have vaccines that have not really very changed for the majority of the world since the 1950s. There's two types. There's killed vaccines, which we use by injection, and then there's a live oral one. And I very much remember in my childhood, those were always given on a sugar cube, which made it the most exciting vaccine that you could possibly have, with no needle and just sugar as the way it was administered. So why do we still have polio as a problem today? And when did this idea of eradicating it come?
So yes, these two vaccines have really been the cornerstone of the fight against polio. And I think both of these vaccines are extremely important in our fight against the disease. They both induce excellent immunogenicity. They have some differences in terms of the mechanism of induction of immunity that leads to our choices of where we use these vaccines. Now, we have had these vaccines for so many decades now, and it has led to this elimination of polio from one region to the other. And that, on top of seeing how smallpox was eradicated, led to this notion that polio can also be eradicated. So in 1988, the World Health Assembly passed this resolution that polio should be eradicated. And that's when the global partnership was also formed. So over time, it has grown. But that's how it started. And it must note, Andy, that the context of when and how it started, it's so important. Because back then, if you look into the 1980s, even though the US, the UK, and most part of the Europe had stopped indigenous polio transmission by then, we still had about 1,000 cases of preventable polio paralysis happening globally every day. That was the burden back then when the eradication program started. And if I, go straight into where we are today, we are in single digits. There were 8 cases of paralytic polio from the wild polio virus from Pakistan and Afghanistan this year so far. So 2 countries, 8 children who were paralyzed with wild polio is that dramatic decline from 1,000 cases every day. However, we haven't been able to stop the virus in these 2 countries. So these 2 countries remain endemic. And that goes back to our understanding around how audacious this challenge is. So for sports fan, back to our cricket notion, Andy, if global health is a sport, then eradication, disease eradication is the Olympics, is the World Cup. Even with this kind of a dramatic progress, really essentially more than 99.9% of the world being free of endemic disease, we're still not done. It's still not success, so to say. So there are challenges, there are complicated challenges in the current era that we live in. If I have to focus just on Pakistan, Afghanistan, there are areas of inaccessibility essentially driven by political and civil unrest where the program cannot reach many children with the vaccination efforts. And that's what predominantly have contributed to polio still being there. There are also complexities, Andy, when it comes to the science part of it, where we are seeing the vaccine-derived polio also emerging in several countries in the Afro region. And although we call them vaccine-derived polioviruses, if you ask me, these are essentially poor vaccination-derived polioviruses, because these strains typically emerge in areas that had persistently poor vaccination activity, vaccination coverage. And then, as I noted, the virus is also notorious. It finds the weakest spots. It can spread very rapidly. So bottom line, we have these two remaining challenges. The one challenge around the wild poliovirus in these two endemic countries, essentially parts of these two endemic countries. The other big challenge is the issue of vaccine-derived variant, particularly in the region of Afro.
So we stick just for a moment with the wild polio, just two countries in the world still that we're aware of with ongoing transmission of those viruses. But you did say at the beginning that there are three different polioviruses. So are all three of those still circulating in those two countries?
That is such an important question. And let me break it down a little bit. So first of all, wild type 2 and wild type 3 have been already certified eradicated. So my question typically in the classes that I teach when it comes to how many diseases we have eradicated, you know, I have a right answer and a smart answer. The right answer is still one, I have to admit. It's still that one disease.
Which is smallpox.
Smallpox, correct. But the smart answer could be 1.67, because two-thirds of the wild poliovirus disease is actually gone and we have never seen them again. So it's only wild type 1 that exists in these two countries. But let me break it down even further. So we do molecular epidemiologic analysis of all the polioviruses.
So that means looking at the genetic code of the virus.
Exactly. So looking at the genetic sequencing or the code of the origin of the virus, and then we trace it back as to where it was last seen, and we do epidemiologic analysis to understand the transmission dynamics. So just to put it simply, we had more than 10 different genetic lineages, in to use your words, different genetic codes of the wild type 1 that we had even a few years ago, 3 to 4 years ago, within Pakistan, Afghanistan. There were these sub-lineages that we were tracking. As you and I speak today, Andy, there are only two remaining lineages. You know, from a medical perspective, the virus is gasping. You know, it's in its last stretch. And even if you look at the geographic footprint, it's not the entire two countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan, that we are having the evidence of active circulation. To put things into context, out of about 34 provinces of Afghanistan, only 7 as of this year are reporting active evidence of transmission. And that doesn't only mean paralysis cases. In Pakistan, out of about 166 districts, there are probably about 35 that have this evidence of transmission. However, challenges are there. These 35 districts or these 7 provinces are the most difficult ones. These are the ones where we have limited access, limited knowledge at times about the number of children there, and there is active conflict in some of these areas.
So getting into these communities, certainly over our careers, has been very difficult. And part of that is around trust, trust in the vaccinators, trust in science. Can you talk a little bit about how that has also fed into some of the difficulties in overcoming polio transmission in not only in those regions, but in other countries as well.
That's the core of it, Andy. The trust from the communities, trust from the healthcare workers that the tool that they're using is critically needed. Also trust from healthcare managers' perspective. The program managers also need to be aligned. So, you know, there are issues of trust at every level, but the critical part is at the community level, at the door of that last child, of that last community where polio is still circulating. How you convince the family members as to the criticality of these vaccine doses, just so the audience understand the scale of the program. Unlike the typical vaccination efforts where the child and the parents come to the vaccination centers, for polio program, we go to the households. We take the vaccines to the children, to the parents at the household levels. And that's where the issue of access and acceptability of who is coming at the doorstep becomes so important, particularly in the situation where they're coming back every other month with the same vaccine. How do you continue to keep, not only build trust, but also keep maintaining trust? I think these are critical issues. And there have been many setbacks and also many examples of significant progress. But there is a broader issue. There is a broader issue of trust in science. And these are all linked. You know, polio can't quite succeed in isolation. I think the overall approach to build trust in science with the right information, with evidence-based data, and then making it contextualized to the communities that we are interacting with, I think these will be essential steps to essentially get to that last child and convince that last family to get vaccinated.
And that these frontline workers that you describe that are real heroes in our public health efforts. And some of them have lost their lives in countries like Pakistan, where they've been targeted because they were promoting vaccination. And I think that really shows those who are continuing to try to protect children, just what heroes they are to do that.
I cannot agree more, Andy. And let me emphasize maybe two points on that issue. One, yes, as you noted, unfortunately, there have been multiple incidents where there have been attacks on not only the innocent vaccinators who are essentially part of the same community, and that has led to a fatal outcome, and many vaccinators have died in this process, have been killed. You know, that's why I keep saying that although we talk about vaccine avoidance behavior, vaccine resistance, vaccine refusal, in some of these extreme instances, this is vaccine violence. But there is another second issue here, and I really want to underscore what you just pointed out. The bravery and the hard work of the frontline vaccinating teams, the vaccinators. Again, if I go back to my metaphor of Global Health Olympics, I think these vaccinators are gold medalists. You know, I have used images that I have seen in front of my eyes where a vaccinator would carry a big vaccine box on the top of his head, standing in knee-deep water in flooded villages of northern Bihar in India. That's the weightlifting champion of the Global Health Olympics for me. We have seen, you know, people, 70-year-old vaccinator, volunteer essentially of the local community, swim across flooded villages. But while he's swimming, he's keeping that vaccine career afloat. That's the swimming gold medalist of the Global Health Olympics that we are taking part in. These are extreme challenges that we have. But at the same time, the goal remains audacious. You know, we still have, you know, to stop this virus. And this goes back to the essence of eradication. You would recall, Andy, the situation in the United Kingdom in 2022, where we had widespread circulation evidence of circulation in the sewage. Same year, the United States reported a paralytic case of polio with, you know, similarity in the origin of the virus to the virus that was circulating in the UK. We also detected similar lineages in Israel, in Canada, eventually also in Indonesia. So this depicts the risk, the fact that the polio-free countries are not polio risk-free. And that's the essence of eradication. That's why we're continuously pushing to getting to zero and maintaining at zero so that polio-free countries become polio risk-free and the world doesn't have this risk of the virus popping back again.
So just to perhaps talk a little bit more about the vaccine-derived polioviruses, and that's the one you were talking about there that we did see in 2022, evidence of transmission in London, but no cases, although, as you say, there was one paralytic case in New York during that small outbreak. It seems a bit of a surprise that a vaccine might be driving some of these outbreaks, particularly in Africa. And what's going on there? Is there a problem with the vaccine itself, or as you were saying earlier, that it's more the under-vaccination of some of the populations? And how do we end up with a virus that we're using as a vaccine that could cause paralytic polio?
It's an extremely important issue, and let me break it down so that we understand this absolutely clearly. The core issue, the central issue, is still poor vaccination. So in countries, in areas where oral polio vaccine, which has the live attenuated strains, in every country where the immunization coverage is optimum, even in the subnational areas, we never see this issue pop up as a public health problem. We only see this issue in areas, as I already noted, of persistently poor immunization coverage. That's where the live attenuated vaccine virus strains have the opportunity to transmit from one person to the other, one vaccinated individual to maybe susceptible and under or unvaccinated individuals. And through the process of this transmission, they regain the neurovirulence that was there in the original virus from where the attenuation was done to develop the vaccine. Typically, it doesn't quite do it on its own. It interacts with the viruses that's there in the host, in the environment. So there are other types of enteric viruses, non-polio enteroviruses, as we call them, also called species C human enteroviruses. These are the partners of the reverted strain of the vaccine virus that has already that setting advantage of poor vaccination. And then if there is this advantage from lots of other enteric viruses in the mix, now that's the problem part of it.
And so if the solution is to make sure everyone's vaccinated so that it can't then spread.
Exactly. The primary solution is to improve vaccination coverage. So if that safe, live, attenuated vaccine virus cannot have too many un- or under-vaccinated individuals to spread into and replicate and find those partners to recombine with, the risk is negligible. So that's the primary solution, to improve vaccination coverage. There is a secondary solution that we have also come up with, and that is to, you know, I call it fixing the loose ends of the vaccine virus. So essentially making the vaccine virus itself less likely to lose the attenuating mutations, even if it's pressured under these situations. So the new vaccine would have less propensity, less risk of reverting into problematic variants compared to the existing vaccine. So it doesn't still, take away anything from the need of vaccination, but it gives the healthcare workers, the program managers, a better chance of reducing the risk of vaccine-derived polioviruses, even in such areas where, for you know, despite the best of the efforts, the vaccination coverage, you know, may not have been improved to the optimum level. So that's how the NOPV2, the novel oral polio vaccine type 2, came into the picture. And by now, as we speak, Andy, about 1 billion doses of this vaccine have been administered in about 38 countries that had this issue of vaccine-derived poliovirus outbreaks. And the use of this vaccine has led to quite a significant reduction in the risk of such emergences. So we are hoping that with this new tool, but essentially on top of the primary premise, the primary principle of proper vaccination efforts, these two combined will probably address this very complicated issue of outbreaks from vaccine-derived polioviruses.
How big a problem are these vaccine-derived viruses? Is that small numbers or very large numbers of cases?
These are bigger numbers compared to the wild poliovirus transmission that we are seeing in two countries. So in 2020 was actually the time when the transmission peaked for vaccine-derived polioviruses. More than 20 countries were infected. 1,000 of cases of paralysis from vaccine-derived polioviruses at the peak of it. It has come down, Andy. So as we speak today, the number is less than 100, about 60 or so cases of paralysis from about 12 countries where we are having active evidence of the transmission still going on. So progress already, particularly post that rollout that I just mentioned of the novel oral polio vaccine type 2. But yes, it's still a very complex issue.
So from the 1980s, hundreds of thousands of paralysis cases every single year, to where we are now with very small numbers of the wild polio and less than 100 of the vaccine derived, and progress, it feels, being made on both fronts. What does the future look like? Are we near to eradication of wild polio, which means none in the world, or is this just a losing battle?
Andy, the answer is in the data. So I mentioned the genetic sequence data, the genetic code data. That to me is the strongest indicator that the wild poliovirus type 1 is on its way out. However, the job is not done yet. There are still these pockets, these districts and provinces that I just mentioned, where there is incomplete access or inconsistent access to vaccinating children. We have to win over that. We have to get access to these remaining families and children to stop the remaining transmission of the wild poliovirus. But from a scientific perspective, from a programmatic perspective, we have never been this close to stopping the virus. And the indications are that we have the tools to stop wild polio. We have the tools, now better tools, to stop vaccine-derived polio. It's the delivery of it, it's the access part of it that continues to remain a challenge, particularly in these specific geographies. So, Andy, I'm very hopeful and cautiously optimistic that progress, even in these last stretches, are being made. But it remains a complicated and challenging task. There is no denying that.
So in the end, the most important thing is getting every child vaccinated. It's access to vaccines. Ananda, thank you so much for being a polio champion and for joining us on this podcast.
Andy, you are an inspiration as always, and thank you for that opportunity to talk with you, and take care.
Thank you very much.
That was the Oxford Colloquy Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, people and facts behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? A colloquy is a discourse or conversation, and I hope you'll agree that that's what we've been having.
Thank you.